I'm honored to be confined at this fine institution with so many exotic types. I will fittingly talk about two exotic disorders, frustration and degeneracy in quantum magnets. Let me acknowledge my colleagues, Shivaji Sondhi and Roderick Messner, first of all. Hong Yao is a student of mine, transferring to Stanford, unfortunately. And acknowledge Chris Hanley for many discussions, and the funding from the NSF and the Research Corporation. Here's an outline of the talk. I will tell you which magnets, particularly frustrated and disordered, and you can also visit this website to see some more literature about it. I will then outline some of the results that we obtained using a large S approach to these magnets, and very briefly state what we've done with Schrödinger bosons at large M, and then summarize. So which magnets? I'm talking about the pyrochlore lattice, which is a network of corner sharing tetrahedra with spins sitting in the corners of these objects. Heisenberg SU2 spins, nearest neighbor Heisenberg interaction. So that's the setting. Now, it turns out that the problem in three dimensions is fairly complicated. So as usual, we'll do a dimensional reduction and go to two dimensions, discuss some of the things that we know for sure about the two-dimensional analogs of this. The analogy is that these are also made out of tetrahedra. The checkerboard is basically a projection of this along the 1-0-0 direction. This is a slice of the pyrochlore lattice, also composed of tetrahedra. This is a one-dimensional system that we also studied, but I probably won't mention it. So we start with Heisenberg spins put on a single tetrahedron, which we will then link into a lattice. And if you diagonalize or minimize the energy of classical spins on this object, then you find that the ground states are given by this condition, that the sum of the spins should be zero. There are many ways to satisfy this. Spins can be collinear, for instance. They can be coplanar, or do not lie in the same plane at all. There are many other states that are characterized by a two-parameter family of states. So there are two angles that specify the relative orientation of the spins so that they add up to zero. And there are global rotations of this object, three more Euler angles. If you talk about quantum spins on the same simplex, then you have 2s plus 1 ground states, which are all singlets and all degenerate for spins of length s. You can basically think about forming a bond 1, 2, and bond 3, 4 with total spins anywhere between 0 and 2s. And each of these multiplets can be bonded to a total spin singlet state, which is a condition for the ground state. So this strong degeneracy of the ground state on one tetrahedron suggests that there is a very strong frustration in the system, in the sense that having to move through all these ground states, it cannot decide in what way to order. Now, the classical system, as Roderick Messner and John Chucker showed, does not show any sign of magnetic order, or any order for that matter, down to temperatures as low as 10 to the minus 4 of JS squared. That was done in Monte Carlo simulations, and they also gave some nice arguments why there should be no order here. And the behavior of the classical model is reminiscent of what the experimentalists see in this compound, where chromium ions form precisely this kind of lattice with spins 3/2 at temperatures above a certain phase transition, which is structural and magnetic in nature. So here I'm going to first describe how one can add the quantumness into the system in small doses by starting at large S and then reducing the spin gradually. And that gives you a small parameter of 1 over S. The challenges of this approach is that there is an extremely large degeneracy when you start at zeroth order in 1 over S. That is, classical states are hugely degenerate. So you have to use some kind of a degenerate perturbation theory. And generally, we know that classical systems like to order one way or another through thermal order by disorder or quantum. But it turns out that in this case, the effective interactions at the 1 over S level, which are zero-point motion of spins, basically, have some gauge-like symmetry. And in gauge theories, we know it's easy to kill order. So this was noted by Chris Henley some time ago. Now, to zero order in 1 over S, when I talk about classical spins, here's the setting. We have a lattice composed of tetrahedra. If I label tetrahedra with Greek letters, then spins are shared by two tetrahedra, so they will have two indices, alpha and beta, for instance, for this spin. In other words, tetrahedra form a diamond lattice, shown here by circles, and spins live on links of this lattice. So you might have a feeling already that this might be a gauge theory of some sort. So the classical energy, as I mentioned, is basically the sum of the total spins squared on each tetrahedron. And so what you want to do is just sum up the spins to zero. And there are many different ways to do that. Now, the first quantum correction, which is done through the Holstein-Primakov expansion of the spin operators in terms of bosons, is basically the zero-point energy of the spin waves, or the Casimir energy. And it arises simply because classical ground states are really not eigenstates of the Hamiltonian for antiferromagnets. Therefore, there will be virtual excitations out of the ground state, which are pairs of megnons. The energy of these virtual excitations is negative. So the more excitations you have of this sort, the lower the energy becomes. And you can quantify it by basically summing up this energy of zero-point motion. Omega A are frequencies of spin waves, which you can calculate classically without doing any quantum mechanics. So the problem then is to find the spin configuration that minimizes this and does not violate, of course, the constraint of the classical ground state. It turns out that when you do this, collinear states fare better than the others. Although there is no formal proof of that, there are many situations in which you can show that. And the basic reason is that as I said, you want to have as many virtual excitations as possible to lower the energy. And the easiest way to produce transverse spin waves, the megnons, is in collinear states. So basically, if you have collinear spins, you have two modes that are transverse. And if you have non-collinear spins, it's down to one. So we'll be looking at collinear states exclusively. And if you're in a collinear state, then you can say that all of the spins are parallel to the z-axis. And then you can parametrize the spins by easing variables now, plus or minus one on each link of this diamond lattice where the spins live. And the spins are now given in terms of these variables, sigma, alpha, beta. So to get the spectrum of the spin waves, and thus to compute the zero-point energy, you solve the classical equations of motion written a few years back by Roderick Mosner and John Chalker. And if you do this for collinear states, then you notice, so here lambda is a transverse fluctuation of the total spin on a tetrahedron. You can write it like this, and then you see that this has a form which is invariant under certain transformations. Namely, you take these transverse fluctuations, multiply by some number, characteristic of a site, and then sigma alpha beta transforms as a link variable. And this has a form of a gauge symmetry, which is a Z2, because lambda can be only plus or minus one in order to keep the length of the spins constant. And so you have equations of motion that are invariant under these gauge-like transformations, something noticed by Chris Handley. So if you have a gauge symmetry in the problem, then you can sort of make these transformations and change spin variables almost at will, and so this will likely kill any magnetic order in the system that you might have. Unfortunately, this is not exactly a gauge symmetry, because there is a constraint. The sum of the spins over the four corners of any tetrahedron should be zero, and some of the gauge transformations might violate this constraint. The gauge transformations are actually very simple. They correspond to flipping spins on a single tetrahedron. So if I apply lambda beta with minus one, then I'll just flip all these four spins. And in doing so, I will perturb the ground state of the neighboring tetrahedra, where there will be an unequal number of up and down spins. So these are not really local gauge transformations. You have to make them in certain ways that preserve the constraint of total spin zero on these tetrahedra.
But it's still extensive?
Depends. It depends on the lattice. On some lattices, it's extensive. On others, it's not. I'll show examples here. So having said that these constraints are sometimes violated, we make a conclusion that the number of equivalent ground states with the same energy is not really 2 to the power of the number of tetrahedra. But nonetheless, these gauge-like transformations do exist, and their number is large, and it turns out that this is enough to kill magnetic order.
So the last statement comes from one of the nerds?
I will give more detail on that. So the question is, what kind of an effective interaction can one find in a theory that has this gauge-like symmetry? Of course, the effective energy of the system must be a gauge-invariant quantity. And the physical variables in this case would be Z2 fluxes, which are basically products of spins around closed loops, like this hexagon here. And just for convenience, I've introduced staggering of these spins on every other side as you go around the loop. But this is not crucial. So you can write down the energy in terms of these Z2 fluxes, starting with single fluxes, then possibly products of two fluxes, and higher order terms, in fact. And a technical problem with this is that actually this expansion is not supposed to be convergent, because this effective energy comes from spin waves, and spin waves are gapless in this system. So you can expect that many body terms will be important here, and for some systems they really are important.
So, so earlier you said that the equation of motion is apparently invariant under this transformation, but the constraint.
You have to keep the constraint. But if you make a gauge transformation and the constraint is respected, then the two states have exactly the same spectra. Therefore, they have exactly the same energy at this order. Mm-hmm. Okay. So if you do have some of transformations that can be made, then you will have degenerate ground states, and you can show that states that have equal fluxes, equal flux configurations, they have exactly the same zero-point energy. So that's the statement.
Then your effective Hamiltonian must only be invariant under some subset of this general class of gauge transformations.
Sure. And the subset is that subset which respects the constraints.
Right. So then, I guess I don't understand the first statement there, that each effective...
Well, it should be invariant under those transformations that respect the constraint. So this is not really a gauge theory, but it turns out that the energy can be expressed in terms of the fluxes. So why is it strange?
Yeah, no, it's fine. Go ahead. Just kind of agree.
All right. So what do we generally expect then from a system with this kind of energetics? Well, temperatures well above JS squared, That's the classical energy scale. We have a paramagnet with independent spins. At temperatures of water of this JS squared, or the Curie-Weiss temperature, it settles into a classical spin liquid without any phase transition. The difference between these two is that in the latter, we have spins adding up to zero on each tetrahedron, more or less, and the spins no longer move individually, they have to move collectively. And it's been measured in zinc chromide that they actually move in groups of six. Temperatures of order JS, one settles into an ensemble of discrete classical states that minimize this zero-point energy, you'll find that spins are roughly collinear, nearest neighbor spins, but not necessarily collinear on long distances. There'll be no nail order, which is thanks to the Z2 gauge theory symmetry. But the system might have other kinds of order, in particular the spin pyrals or valence bond order. Now, if you go to lower temperature, then there will be additional quantum corrections, such as magnet interactions, for instance. And then, presumably at that point, the system will find one or another ground state that it likes best. At least this was the experience with the Kagome interferomagnet, for instance. And typically for the pyrochlore, one expects very large magnetic unit cells, as indeed happens in zinc chromite when it settles into a spin-ordered state at low temperatures. So what do we find once we do this mathematics? We find, well, we don't know what we find for the 3D pyrochlore lattice yet. It's work in progress. The two-dimensional analogs, though, have been characterized, and we find that this particular antiferromagnet has a valence bond order with a Z2 cross Z2 order parameter, which is somewhat reminiscent of the spin 1/2 case that was studied numerically by Lullier and her co-workers. In the 111 slice of the pyrochlore, we find also a valence bond crystal at low temperatures, which has the symmetry breaking of the Q equal to 4 Potts model. So let me give you some details about the checkerboard antiferromagnet, what happens there. The number of classical ground states selected by quantum fluctuations is not extensive. It's 2 to the power L, where L is the linear size. Now, it turns out that the zero-point energy is minimized by configurations where this flux that I defined on empty plaquettes is 0 or plus 1 in Z2 terms. That is, in other words, the bonds across empty squares must be equally happy or equally frustrated. So here, color coding these, the colored bonds are frustrated, they have parallel spins. Black bonds are happy. So here's one ground state. This is the ground state of the square lattice antiferromagnet without diagonal links, essentially.
You might have said it, but diagonal links are the same strength.
They are.
Is that important?
Well, if you make them a little weaker, then you have a unique ground state. That is the ground state of the square lattice. If you make them stronger, you end up with one-dimensional chains that are classically decoupled, and there will be some coupling at the next level in 1 over S. Now, here's another ground state. I frustrate all the vertical bonds, and you still see that this rule applies. So that state has the same energy as the previous one. This one here has horizontal and vertical bonds frustrated in alternation, still the same energy. This one is even less periodic than that. They all have the same energy. So if you analyze the structure of these states, then you find that they can be divided into 4 disjoint thermal ensemble, each of which breaks the symmetry of the lattice. Right? And the symmetry breaking pattern is such that you have to specify which bonds are happy. And these bonds are shown shaded. So one ensemble would be where all the horizontal bonds are happy and the other bonds fluctuate. So you go from one configuration to another, by thermal excitations, and you average over them, you get something like that. Another one is related by symmetry to it, with all vertical bonds happy. Now, it's a quark of 1 over s that there are two other states that are exactly degenerate with these. One of them is this one, where half of the tetrahedra have vertical bonds and the other half have horizontal bonds happy. And then it's twin, this one. And now, if you look at it closely, then you find that actually it resembles the state that Claire Lelier and the company found for the spin 1/2, at least as far as the symmetry breaking pattern is concerned. So the happy bonds here congregate around white plaquettes, half of them. So depending on whether it's this half or the other, you have a broken symmetry state. So this is a valence bond crystal in some sense, although it's a bit perverse to speak of a valence bond crystal at large S, but it's a spin pyrrhus order. There is no nail magnetization here in this state, but the bond order exists.
Is that a statement at a specific order in 1 over S?
It is a statement, yes.
It will be magnetically ordered.
It will be magnetically ordered at zero temperature only. Yeah. It's two dimensions.
Yeah.
Right. So.
But at zero temperature.
At zero temperature, you have to go beyond 1 over S. Right. So this is a temperature of order JS. Recently, Joel Moore looked at the system and found that there is indeed a thermal phase transition with the symmetry breaking of this type. Now, the 1-1-1 slice of the pyrochlore lattice is a somewhat different story. I like it better than the checkerboard because it sort of preserves the Z3 symmetry inherent to the pyrochlore, right? So there are three pairs of bonds, and here they're all equivalent. In the previous system, you had vertical and horizontal bonds not quite equivalent to the diagonal bonds. So this was a little closer to the real pyrochlore. So therefore, I decided to look into it. And again, here we have collinear ground states. The Z2 gauge quote-unquote symmetry applies. And we can make an educated guess as far as which ground states would be picked up by the quantum fluctuations. And it would be, if we do a Chris Hanley type expansion of the spin waves here, then we would find that the flux around the Z2 flux around the hexagons should be +1. So there will be an odd number of up and down spins around each hexagon. So that would be a ground state. Again, this is on the basis of just truncating the Hamiltonian that includes one flux terms, two flux terms, and so on at the level of one flux. So we have a state with a uniform flux, and that's a guess. Let's see what kind of a state this would be. So the fact that the flux is +1 can be translated into the language of bonds rather than spins, and that's to say that there will be either two bonds with frustration, so here they are shown in red, or none. And you have to count only one type of tetrahedra pointing up or pointing down, because each spin belongs to belongs to two bonds. So you can look at these three, and there will be two frustrated bonds. These three have none. Now, it turns out that these states can be mapped onto classical dimer coverings of the triangular lattice. The triangular lattice is formed by the tetrahedra of one orientation. The other sublattice of tetrahedra forms another triangular lattice. And the mapping proceeds as follows. We take the frustrated bonds. Each tetrahedron has one frustrated bond on its perimeter. And on each hexagon, there are either 0 or 2, which means that the dimers have to be paired across a hexagon. And so we do this pairing, and these black lines are the dimers. So every classical ground state selected by quantum fluctuations correspond to a dimer covering on this lattice. And since the properties of the classical dimers on the triangular lattice are well known, one can make statements about presence or absence of nail order or any other kind of order here. So one can show that there is no nail order and there is no valence bond order either. So it's a sort of a classical valence bond liquid, if you will. And you can also point out here the existence of a Z2 topological order, which is basically the number of these dimers crossed as you draw a line through the entire system. So that's the Z2 flux through the holes of the torus. Now, that was a guess, and actually, if you do the minimization numerically, the ground states are not these. Right? So it's not a classical valence bond liquid. What are they? Well, it turns out that the fluxes are non-uniform, and that tells you that the many-body part of the flux effective energy is more complicated than one can assume. So it turns out that one quarter of the fluxes have to be pi, and they have to be spaced regularly on the lattice, so one breaks the translational symmetry by putting them in certain order. So there's a 2x2 unit cell, and this set of ground states can be mapped onto dimers again. The lattice will be slightly different on which the dimers live. You have to decorate the triangular lattice. And again, there will be no spin order, but the system will show non-uniform bond averages SI dot SJ. The ones shown here in thicker lines are more antiferromagnetic bonds than the others. So if you look at this carefully, then you find that there are sort of four types of tetrahedra of one orientation. Say if we pick up the tetrahedra pointing up, we have this type. This type is completely symmetric. This one is different from this and is different from that. That's the same kind of pattern that Harris, Berlinski, and Bruder found for the spin 1/2 pyrochlore when they wrote some kind of a mean field theory for valence bond order back in 1991. But again, this is just a slice of the pyrochlore lattice, so it doesn't have to be the same, of course. So that's as far as the large S approach is concerned. And these exercises basically showed us that no matter what you try to do to the pyrochlore lattice, no matter how you slice it, it tries to have valence bond order or spin pyrals order. So we, even earlier than that, we studied the a large N study of the same compound in terms of the Schwinger bosons, where you represent spins in terms of bilinears in bosonic operators like this, with the total number of bosons on the side giving the spin length, and in which the dot product of the spins is written in terms of boson pair operators, where the pairs are in the spin singlet state. This approach is particularly suitable for finding spin liquids in frustrated magnets, mainly because the operators here are spin singlets to start with. So this is some kind of an RVB state. And these live on a bond. So when applied to magnets with frustration, it usually produces a featureless quantum ground state with deconfined spin 1/2 excitations and topological order. And that has been done to square lattice with frustration, coupling J1 and J2, triangular lattice, Kagome, and here are the usual suspects. In contrast, on the pyrochlore, we find that the ground state tends to break some symmetries. The ground state is not featureless. So even at the mean field level, one finds that either lattice symmetry tends to be broken or strangely time reversal symmetry. I don't have time to explain in all the details how this comes about, but I can sort of briefly tell you a rationalization for this. It turns out that the SPN saddle points, the large N saddle points, are related to classical vacua of the corresponding Heisenberg model in the following way. One takes a classical ground state on a simplex and disorders it basically by applying global rotations to all four spins, or however many spins you have on that simplex, without changing the relative angles between the spins. So just global rotations. If you did this to a state of this form, then you would end up with a state that is rotationally invariant, but the angles between spins are different, so you have some sort of a spin parallels or valence bond order, with the red bonds being antiferromagnetic and the black bonds being ferromagnetic. If you took this state where the spins lie in the same plane, again you would have two bonds with antiferromagnetic correlations and the other bonds showing no correlations. Now, so these kinds of states would violate not the SU2 symmetry, which would be intact because this is averaged over all rotations, but it would violate the lattice symmetries. Good. Now in this case, this is a state where all the angles between the spins are equal, 109 degrees between for each pair. So if you averaged over global rotations here, you would not break any lattice symmetry in that case. So that would not show any spin parallels order. But on the other hand, it turns out that this state violates the time reversal symmetry. You can check that by constructing its twin, time reversed twin, and making sure that actually the two configurations cannot be rotated into each other globally. So it means that they give rise to different states. You can also check that by using an order parameter like this. It's obviously zero for collinear states or for coplanar states as well. But for this state, it will be non-zero. It will be either positive or negative, depending on which of the pair you take, this one or the time reversed one. So if you did the same to the triangles, then you would find that there is only one state, basically, with spins making angles of 120 degrees to each other. And then you can globally rotate all such states into each other. So there's only one state in SPN that you find on a triangle then. So that's the difference between triangles and tetrahedra, and that's the reason why on Kagome, or the triangular lattice, it was easy to find a unique ground state, whereas in the pyrochlore, in the SPN theory, you find lots and lots of settle points at the mean field level, which are actually very close in energy.
One question. So, if I understood you correctly, there is a case where you have broken time reversal but no broken lattice symmetry.
Right.
So presumably in that mean field state, those bond variables, their expectation values uniform.
They are.
So what's the nature of the, if you go beyond mean field?
Well, if you go beyond mean field, then this would be a deconfined phase.
Right, but with broken time reversal.
Right, but in addition to that, it has a broken time reversal symmetry.
And it'd be a U1 deconfined?
Well, we haven't finished this, but that probably is the case. So I'm pretty much done, in fact. So what I've told you today is that we've studied a pyrochlore antiferromagnet of the Heisenberg type, which has a strongly degenerate classical ground state with one continuous degree of freedom per tetrahedron, in which no order of any kind is detected at the classical level. If you study the large S approximation or scheme, then to the leading order in 1 over S, you find that collinear ground states are preferred, and the preferred states are all related by a Z2 gauge-like symmetry. Because this is a Z2 gauge symmetry, one finds no nail order in the ensemble of those states, but there is valence bond order in both lattices that we considered, and currently we're working on the three-dimensional pyrochlore. Schwinger boson analysis at large N shows that the ground state is not featureless, really. It has either valence bond order or broken time reversal symmetry. Which one of these and what kind of a unit lattice, unit cell you have, and so on, that depends on the details of the interactions. That seems to be still very strongly sensitive to that. Now, in spin-on deconfinement, to answer your question again, is probably possible in the state with the broken T, but probably not in the valence bond state, because that sort of is similar to collinear states. All right, thank you for your attention.
Questions? Yes, so in the Stringer boson approach, in the valence bond ordered states, these bond variables are zero on some bonds, or they are just non-uniform?
It depends. Since we don't know the exact ground state, it's hard to tell. The ones that we found, for some of them, they're zero actually on some bonds. Mm-hmm. So we have a maximally asymmetric state. There are some solutions where some bonds are non-zero, but other bonds are more non-zero.
Right. So in those sorts of states, you'd again presumably expect spinor-Dey confinement.
Probably not. Actually, if it's a bipartite, then there will be no Dey confinement. But these are not bipartite.
Okay, it's 3D, right? So bipartite.
So if you can make your lattice bipartite.
Even in 3D, you think it'll be confined?
I think you're only just trying to think to what it would mean to spin a half, literally at large.
Right. Okay.
If some of the bonds are non-zero, then all of them are non-zero, then you could have coexisting zones for large
and right. Large n, that's what
right.
You get.
Just saying,
spin a half.
Well, spin a half, we don't
know
it. No. Yeah, it's hard to tell.
So it's the states which other people.
Right. Okay. Other questions?
I guess, didn't really discuss the large S expansion, how you get the valence bond order. I mean, do you know the solution for the pyroclore, or just only on simpler lattices?
It's on simpler lattices at this point. So the 3D pyroclore, we're working on it.
The mechanism of selection in the on the simpler lattices?
The mechanism is that you have still degenerate states, even at the 1 over S level.
Yes.
So if you're in a thermal ensemble at some low temperature, your system goes through these states. But you can show that there are four disjoint ensembles in each case. That is, if you...
It's on the ground state at large S.
It's not a ground state. It's a thermal ensemble. Right. So if you go to the ground state, then you have to include the 1 over S squared corrections and so on.
That's right. So have you done that?
Oh. We haven't done this. Chris Henley is working on this. He can probably answer that.
But so then what is the statement that you have Valence bond order?
Finite temperature you have.
Uh-huh.
But if you're at zero temperature, then it'll be a different story.
So did you guys sort out this issue with the valence bond crystal on the Kagome slab in the following sense, that the fact that you have some preferential positions for the bonds doesn't rule out the possibility of actually, for purposes, disordered state? Like if I took a triangular lattice and said that dimers don't like one particular directions, it still would be more or less a liquid state, right? With some signatures of valence bond state, but I would still have deconfinement and everything like that, sort of all the signatures of the liquid. So do you know what happens?
The statement is that it breaks a translational symmetry, that's all. You can form an order parameter that shows that this is a spin spiral state.
All right, but if you truncate the correlations, sort of taking that into account, can you say more about what happens?
This is a thermal state, right?
All right.
Anyone else? If not, my colleague. Since Oleg thoughtfully finished, we have enough time to spare. I'll just do one thing. Steve Kibbleson had a comment to contribute, actually some data of Stuart Brown on the issue of transitions between spin pirals and nail states. And so why don't we use this slot to make that comment, and that way we don't have to, oh, you're going to have to go get it. You'll run. That way we'll finish in time instead of tacking it on at the end.
Oh, it's Stuart Brown's stuff. Yeah, I've seen him. Is there any new data? I actually looked at the old stuff, but it's a different black. We don't know. We can't see the data.
So I thought it might be worthwhile bringing to people's attention that there is an experimental system in which a zero temperature direct transition between a spin pyral state that's basically a columnar state and a Néel state has been observed experimentally. It's in the Beschgard salts, and there's some generalized phase diagram which is here, where basically pressure is going across this way and temperature is going that way, but pressure is also varied by some chemical means at times as well. And the phase diagram, this phase diagram represents some relatively recent work, but for the first decade and a half of the history of this field, people were so convinced by the Landau argument that the transition had to be strongly first order that the phase diagram was actually drawn with a horizontal top and a vertical line, and nobody actually bothered to go in close and look at the transition. These are, in this range, these materials are insulating, so this is, it's spin physics we're talking about here. The material, exactly what dimension we're looking at isn't completely clear here. These are complicated materials. They're charge transfer salts. And because they're insulating, we don't really even know what the resistivity anisotropy is, but there are sort of band structure estimates of what the anisotropy is. So there's the ratio of the estimated hopping matrix elements are shown here. It's 1 in the most conducting direction to 0.1 to 0.01. 0.003. So there are polemical discussions about whether these are quasi 1D or quasi 2D.
Is it clear what spin we should be thinking
of? Spin half. Yeah, that's clear. So this was discovered then by Stuart Brown in 1998 there's not that much data on these materials because it's not that many things you can measure at high pressure in small crystals. So there's basically transport data and NMR data.
There's more data there.
I heard that at a talk at Hebrew University, a speaker got a cell phone call and asked the audience to wait a minute while he took it. At any rate, what Stuart discovered is that the transitions coming to this critical pressure from both sides really plummeted. So it looks like you're approaching a quantum critical point. And you can see that the transition temperature actually, you know, does drop by quite a significant amount on both sides. There's reason to believe, I mean, at low, very low temperature, it's not exactly clear what happens. There's disorder, and it's probable that the transition ultimately becomes first order and is broadened by disorder. But at any rate, it comes remarkably close to being a continuous transition, and that's the good news. This is 1 over T1 measured from NMR. This is just on the antiferromagnetic side, so you see the antiferromagnetic transition here. This is just on the spin pyrrole side, and so you see the opening of a spin gap. And this is at the critical pressure, and you see a power law behavior of 1 over T1, namely it goes like the temperature to the zero power. It's twofold degenerate because this isn't a square lattice, it's an anisotropic system.
Staggered.
You mean from chain to chain? I'm not sure they know. What?
My memory is it's staggered, you just said it was columnar.
I think they don't know, actually. It's they know how many environments there are, but there's no diffraction data. So it's a spin pyrrole state which doubles the unit cell. That's all you really know. So there are possible interpretations that I don't think any of them completely hang together. There was the idea that this was actually quasi 2D, and you should think of it, if you're not too close to the critical point, in terms of the 2D nonlinear sigma model, and then you would expect that 1 over T1 goes like the temperature to the minus eta, and eta is zero for all practical purposes. If you notice, these transition temperatures seem to come in with infinite slope, so that suggests a new Z that's less than 1, which is reasonable. On the other hand, I think that in this scenario, you'd want to think that the spin pyrrole state was some dangerously irrelevant operator, so you would imagine, I think, that that transition temperature would come in with a higher power. If it's quasi 1D, I think 1 over T1 is going to be some logarithms, and that's probably also consistent with with temperature to the zero. I think the exotic critical points, if I understand it correctly, would give a big eta, and that's not seen. All right, so anyway, I thought that might be a relevant piece of information.
So, is there any guess for what the J and, you know, there are two different J's, J and a J prime.
Yeah.
Is there any guess for what the J and
J prime? Some people can't help doing RG transformations, I'm not sure what.
you know, there is a transition temperature. I don't, you know, there's NMR is basically all there is. There's no neutron scattering, so you can't measure spin wave velocity. No,
because this NMR data, it's basically the same from 40 Kelvin to 10 Kelvin or something.
Right.
And here all these scales, this thing ends at 20 Kelvin.
You mean the nail temperature goes up to 20 Kelvin. But, you know, the nail temperature is going to be reduced by low dimensional fluctuations, no matter whether you think it's quasi-1D or quasi-2D.
If I remember correctly, 1 over T1 goes to the beta, not minus.
T to the...
Well,
it's zero.
Because large, it is, you know, it's not, you don't expect to be that
much.
Somebody else can verify that. I'm pretty sure. It's
You're probably right.
It should. So then the implication for the last point may be somewhat different.
Just the background.
Well, it's 1 over T1T is really the response function.
Yes.
So 1 over T1T will diverge. This is a diverging 1 over T1T. Well, 8 would have to be bigger than 1. I mean, 1 over T1T is the response function, right? So that's diverging like 1 over T1 going like a constant means that 1 over T1T is diverging like 1 over T.
Well, of course, that's algebra, but 1 over T1, 1 over T1 is the Q integral of chi double prime of Q and omega.
No, 1 over T1T is.
Oh, okay, fine, probably.
Yeah.
Does this stuff expand much over this temperature range? Is there much thermal expansion at this temperature range? A lot of these things that we saw.
Yeah, this is pretty low temperature. I don't know. I don't think so.
I don't think there's any thermal expansion at the temperature range.
Yeah.
There is significant amount at higher
temperatures. At higher temperatures, yeah.
I'm not aware in these picker materials of any magnetic frustration, but there is strong electron-phonon coupling. So a simpler explanation would be that this is just a traditional spin piles transition. You've got weakly coupled any ferromagnetic change with strong electron-phonon coupling. So.
I'm not sure that matters for this purpose.
In terms of connecting to theory,
I'm not sure it matters. You integrate out the phonons, you have some effective magnetic model at low energies.
Okay.
And the lack of two-dimensional symmetry certainly matters.
I just want to point out that there is another NMR puzzle in these materials, which is sitting on the other lobe of this antiferromagnetic insulating phase when the system becomes metallic at the other critical point.
Oh, yeah.
There is also a plateau of 1 over T1, over there, to the right, around 40 kilobar. And above the superconducting temperature. There is also a plateau of 1 over T1 in about the same temperature range. And that was interpreted many years ago as an evidence for Legendre liquid behavior, but I think this interpretation is completely untenable in that temperature range. So there's something to explain there, too.
You see, there's this LL to FL up there. I think that's what it's referring to.
Right. No, but that LL to FL, if it exists, can only be above 100 Kelvin. I don't think it's possible to claim that these materials are Legendre liquids below 100 Kelvin or so.
No, I agree with you. I'm just saying that's indicating a place where there is a crossover in the experimental data. I'm not signing on to that interpretation of it.
No. But what I'm trying to say is that the NMR has another crossover around 15 Kelvin.
Oh, right.
Much 15. Below that. There are two crossovers. That's what I'm trying to say. There is one in transport around 100 Kelvin, which is your LL to FL.
No, it isn't. That's at 10 Kelvin.
No.
I mean, well, okay, anyway. Steve,
okay, we can discuss that. This LL to FL has to be put around 100 K.
Okay. Anyway, it's a separate issue. These are the materials are insulating here, so we're looking at spin physics over here. There's metallic physics over on this side.
mean, if it's so close to, I mean, if the pressure, you can drive it metallic, then how do we know that a spin-only description or such thing is?
I mean, what we know is that it's strongly insulating. That there's a, and actually, from some of these compounds, there's optics where you can see a spin gap. Oh, I mean, a charge gap.
And it's big?
What? You're asking me what the magnitude is. I don't remember. Maybe you know. Do you know how big the gaps they see in optics are in this region?
I used to know that.
Yeah, I did too.
100 Kelvin is my value.
That's pretty small.
Which X was it?
What?
Yeah, 6 over R.
The data you actually shows.
So this, the data is for PF6.
Is that a relevant operator?
Is it what?
These
SU2
symmetrics
ones? Yes. I mean, well, not perfectly, but they're spin a half. So.
No, if you want to know what's magnetic isotrope.
What?
Magnetically isotrope.
So they're spin a half, so there's no single ion anisotropy. There's going to be some weak anisotropy, but, you know, for our purposes, they're isotropic.
Steve, I mean, anisotropy has been measured. There is a spin-flop transition in these materials, so it's not too big, I think. It's like,
yeah, I mean, so there is easy access, and it's like...
I think if I remember from that, you can actually estimate the scale of J's. So there's also antiferromagnetic resonance, which you can just measure. As you approach the spin-flop transition, there is a low-energy mode, which you can pick up in this gigahertz microwave. I think it's sort of roughly consistent with TNAO. I don't remember the exact number.
No, it's bigger than TNAO. There's what?
Okay, I don't remember the number, but I think the anisotropy came out to be of sort of like maybe actually less than 1%, but it was noticeable.
All right, that's not so bad for a 5-minute intervention.
How long was it?
You just brought us to 3, which is where we were supposed to be for the next talk. Thank you very much.